Welcome back to Dark Florida, the podcast where we dive into the eerie, the unexplained, and the downright chilling stories from the Sunshine State and beyond. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland, and I've got some exciting news. I'll be a participant in the Skunk Ape Roundtable at this year's Great Florida Bigfoot Conference on April 5th. If you're a Bigfoot enthusiast, a cryptid researcher, or just curious about the mysteries lurking in the wilds of Florida, this is the place to be. Get your tickets at gatherupevents.com and come find me. I'll be there ready to chat, answer your questions, and most importantly, hear your stories. And speaking of stories, if you have a strange encounter, a cryptid sighting, or anything unexplained that you'd like to share, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. Whether you want to be a guest on the show or just share your experience, my inbox is always open. Now, let's dive into today's episode, a case that remains one of the most baffling unsolved mysteries of the 20th century, the Lead Mass Case. In 1966, two men were found dead on a hillside in Brazil under truly bizarre circumstances, wearing lead masks and carrying cryptic notes, and with no clear cause of death. Were they the victims of a secret experiment, a strange cult, or something even more otherworldly? Let's unravel the mystery. It's August 21st, 1966. And while most of us associate August with the sweltering summer heat, in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, it was actually a chilly day because Brazil is in the southern hemisphere. But it wasn't just an ordinary chilly day. This was the day when two electronic technicians, Manuel Pereira de Cruz, age 32, and Miguel Jose Viana, age 34, were found dead on the slopes of Vietnam Hill, a remote and desolate area on the outskirts of Rio. Two men, both in their 30s, lying side by side in the grass. They're fully dressed in suits. They had raincoats on too. But it gets even stranger. To top it all off, they were wearing lead masks over their eyes. Nothing about this case is normal. No, this is the kind of mystery that makes you immediately start looking for answers. And this is the kind of case that keeps you coming back and wondering, what happened on that August day? What drove these two men, healthy, seemingly ordinary individuals, to leave their hometown and travel nearly 174 miles to Rio, climb that hill, only to never return alive? What happened on that fateful day? Friends, Miguel and Manuel were residents of Campos dos Guates, a city in the state of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Together, they owned a small television repair shop and were well respected within the community, particularly for their expertise in electronics. Miguel was married to Elisa Gomez Viana, while Manuel was married to Nelly de Cruz. Both men had studied electronics in São Paulo, and Miguel had furthered his education through a correspondence course in electronics from the National Schools in Los Angeles, which he completed in 1951. He also had connections with other technical institutions in the United States, including the Hollywood Radio and Television Institute in California. They were both practicing spiritualism. 1960s Brazil, spiritualism was quite a popular movement. By the early 1960s, Spiritism had established over 3,000 places of worship in Brazil, along with numerous educational and medical facilities. Most viewed Spiritism as a practical, scientific approach to spirituality, contrasting sharply with the ritualistic elements that are found in the Afro-Brazilian religions. A few months prior to their deaths, on May 12, 1966, Miguel, Manuel, and their friend Alicia Gomez are reportedly involved in some kind of experiment on Atafona Beach, which is a popular tourist spot near Campos. Now, I don't know what kind of experiment they were running, but let's just say that it did not end quietly. Because at around 9 p.m., there was a massive explosion. There was a huge blast that lit up the night sky with a giant ball of fire. The sound was so loud it could be heard from 10 kilometers away. People in the area reported that they felt the ground shake, and some nearby houses even suffered minor damages. In fact, one local movie theater had to be interrupted because everyone inside panicked. Now, here's where things get really interesting. The rumor at the time? A flying saucer had crashed into the ocean. Yes, you heard that right. A local man claimed he saw a glowing ship in the distance before it suddenly disappeared into the water. The explosion was so big, it caught the attention of the Navy, who launched a formal investigation. And it wasn't just the Navy who took notice. Detective Walter Fernandez from the local police station also heard the explosion. In fact, he felt the entire police station shake. Naturally, he went out to investigate. When he got to the beach, he noticed something strange. A strong smell of sulfur. And there, in the sand, were these weird tracks, 35 centimeters wide and 25 centimeters deep, that looked like they were made by giant tires. Detective Fernandez took some testimonies from witnesses and reported the incident to his superiors. But the question still lingered. What really caused those tracks? And what was that sulfur smell about? What had people seen in the sky? What crashed into the ocean? And here's another piece of the puzzle. Sometime before the explosion, Miguel had contacted a man named Everesto Fidelis de Moraes, a clandestine ham radio operator who supposedly owned a powerful radio transmitter. His setup was only about 300 meters away from Atafona Beach, and the topic of their conversation still remains unknown. Then, in June 1966, a homemade device exploded in the garden of Manuel's home. Photographs from the incident show Manuel's father, Sebastio Pereira de Cruz, standing near the blast site, examining the scattered remnants of metal pipes and wires. That takes us to August 16, 1966. The day prior to the event, Manuel tells his wife that he and Miguel are heading to São Paulo to buy a used car and pick up some electronic components for their shop. Manuel packs a huge amount of cash for the trip, over 2 million in Brazilian cruzeiros. Some sources say it was around 4 to 6 million. Either way, we're talking about a life-changing amount of money here. Manuel also packs two towels in a separate bag. And some friends know that Miguel and Manuel are going to São Paulo and ask them to bring back a few things from the city for them. The friends even give the men money to cover the cost. On August 17th, 1966, according to their families, Cruz and Vienna had told everyone they were heading to São Paulo. Their mission? To buy a used Volkswagen sedan and pick up some electronic equipment while they were in the city. But here's where things begin to get a little suspicious. The men were carrying 2.3 cruzeiros with them, which is a lot of money for back then. On the morning of August 17th, Cruz and Vienna asked their friend Gomez to drop them off at the bus station. Gomez agreed, and they said their goodbyes around 9 a.m., Gomez did offer to go inside the station with them, but Cruz and Vienna insisted that he didn't need to. And that, my friends, is where the very first red flag pops up. Because as it turns out, Cruz and Vienna weren't actually planning to go to São Paulo at all. No. Instead, they bought two tickets for Niterói, a city that, spoiler alert, is not São Paulo. And for reference, Niterói is 443 kilometers in the opposite direction of São Paulo. So why lie? Were they trying to throw someone off their trail? Or was this just the case of two guys who really didn't want their friend tagging along? We may never know. The men arrive in Niterói around 2 p.m. It's raining, and it's unclear if anyone was waiting for them upon their arrival. The men made a quick stop at an electronic store called Flowscope. Now, the clerk remembered them because they were regulars, always popping in to buy various parts and gadgets. During this encounter, though, Miguel showed the owner a magazine advertisement for an AM/FM frequency generator priced at over 1 million cruzeiros. While at the store, they also inquired about specific components from Philip, but the store did not have them in stock. The manager found their request unusual, as both Miguel and Manuel were experienced technicians who should have known that such components were not typically readily available. So this time, they left the store empty-handed. No wires, no transistors, nothing. But here's where it gets even weirder. Right after leaving the store at around 2:45 p.m., Cruz and Vienna swung by a nearby clothing store and bought two raincoats for around 10,000 each. Even though it was raining out, they left the store without ever putting on their new rain jackets. The salesperson later confirmed that the two men seemed to be in a big hurry. At 3 p.m., Cruz and Vienna popped into a bar near the clothing store. Vienna ordered mineral water. Not only that, he asked for a receipt so he could later return the bottle for the deposit. So that would give you the impression that they were going to return the bottle at some point. If this was some kind of suicide pact, why request a receipt? But here's where it gets interesting. The bartender noticed that Cruz and Vienna kept glancing at the clock, like they were waiting for someone or something. But who were they waiting for? Or better yet, what were they waiting for? That takes us to 5 p.m. when we get our next sighting. A security guard spotted Cruz and Vienna near Vietnam Hill, the same hill where their bodies would later be found. But here's the twist. They weren't alone. According to the guard, the men arrived in a Jeep driven by a man with blonde hair. And get this, he claims there were at least two other people in the vehicle, though the guard couldn't get a good look at them. So now we've got a mystery Jeep, a blonde driver, and a couple of shadowy figures. But here's where the trail goes cold. After that sighting, no one knows what happens next. Did they argue? Did they make some kind of deal? Did they accidentally consume something that they shouldn't have? All we know is that 3 days later, Cruz and Vienna were found dead on top of Vietnam Hill, their bodies lying side by side in the grass, and those eerie lead masks still covering their eyes. Then later that evening, on the 17th, at 7 p.m., Gracinda Barbosa was driving near Vietnam Hill with her three children when they noticed unusual lights in the sky. Curious, they pulled over and stepped out of the car to observe the phenomena for about 4 minutes. Gracinda described the object as a glowing, oval-shaped orange light surrounded by a ring of fire, emitting blue rays in multiple directions as it moved up and down the hill. When she returned home, she recounted the strange sighting to her husband. Intrigued, Paolo went to the location himself, but saw nothing unusual. Uncertain of what they had witnessed, they decided to keep the experience to themselves for the time being. On the morning of August 18th, 1966, a young boy was setting up small traps for animals atop of Vietnam Hill when he stumbled upon a startling sight. Two men lying motionless on the ground, unsure whether they were asleep or if something far more serious. Panic set in and he bolted down the hill. He ran straight to the home of Antonio Guerrero de Castro, a nearby policeman, and breathlessly recounted what he had seen. However, the officer dismissed the boy's story, assuming it was nothing significant, and chose not to investigate. 2 days later, on the afternoon of August 20th, 1966, another boy was atop Vietnam Hill, trying to retrieve a kite tangled in a tree. As he climbed, he spotted something eerie. The bodies of the two men lying side by side. Unnerved by this discovery, he made his way back to town and reported what he had seen to the local police station. However, with daylight fading and the weather turning unfavorable, the authorities decided to postpone the climb up the hill until the following day. On August 21st, the next morning, at first light, a team of police officers, firefighters, reporters, and curious onlookers began the climb up the difficult Vietnam Hill to recover the bodies. Due to the rough terrain and lingering bad weather, the ascent took over 2 hours. When they finally reached the scene, A small clearing about 10 square meters in size, at the very top of the hill, they were met with a bizarre and truly unsettling sight. Lying side by side were the bodies of Miguel and Manuel, both dressed in identical suits and covered by raincoats. Their bodies were quickly confirmed as they were still carrying their personal documents. Strangely, both men had traces of blood around their mouths and noses. Their bodies were positioned on top of a spread of freshly cut pindoba palm leaves, which were also stained with blood. And oddly, the pindoba leaves require a knife to cut, yet no blade was found at the scene. Scattered around their bodies, investigators discovered a puzzling collection of objects: a nearly empty bottle of mineral water, two makeshift aluminum foil cups, a package containing two towels, a wedding ring tied to a pair of reading glasses that was found in Miguel's jacket, a wristwatch which was tucked into Miguel's pants, $7,000 hidden in a plastic bag in Miguel's pants, and $4,000 inside of Miguel's jacket. A unfolded, unused handkerchief embroidered with the initials AMS. Receipt for the mineral water bottle. A pack of matches and some cigarettes in Miguel's jacket. Two unused bus tickets from Tiro to Campos. And square pieces of cellophane paper impregnated with an unknown substance. A newspaper dated August 17th, two crude masks made of solid lead and shaped like sunglasses but without eye holes, a handwritten note featuring a strange combination of letters and numbers resembling a code, and a final handwritten note with cryptic instructions that was found in Miguel's pocket. The presence of the lead masks, the coded notes, and the peculiar arrangement of objects only deepened the mystery, leaving investigators and the public wondering what truly happened on Vietnam Hill. Now, let's talk about the autopsies, or more accurately, the lack thereof. When the bodies were first discovered, the cause of death was a complete mystery. The police investigation was launched under the leadership of Jose Betancourt, the chief officer of the local police station. The bodies of Miguel and Manuel were transported to the coroner's office, but the timing proved to be less than ideal. The morgue was already overwhelmed that day due to the presence of another high-profile case. The body of an important detective resulted in the mounting pressure from law enforcement to prioritize his autopsy first. To make matters even more complicated, the coroner himself was absent, leaving an assistant to handle Miguel and Manuel's examination. In a clear departure from the standard protocol, this assistant personally oversaw the preparation for the autopsy, including the removal of their internal organs. And despite the unusual circumstances, the initial report noted no visible signs of violence or injury on either body, further deepening the mystery that's surrounding their death. Because the coroner's office had a backlog of cases, and by the time they got around to examining the men, their internal organs had decomposed. No toxicology report was ever done because their internal organs weren't stored properly. Their bodies had decomposed to the point where testing was basically impossible. The medical examiner did their best with what they had. Based on the timeline, it was determined that Cruz and Vienna likely died on August 17th, the same day that they were last seen alive. But here's the thing. Even without the toxicology report, the police still had other pieces of evidence to work with. And let me tell you, this case was like a jigsaw puzzle where half the pieces are missing and the other half are covered in cryptic symbols. On August 22nd, Miguel's brother, Herval Viana, goes to the coroner's office in Naturo to claim the bodies. And 2 days later, on August 24th, Miguel and Manuel were laid to rest at the Caju Cemetery in Campos. Meanwhile, a reporter who was visiting the coroner's office uncovered a shocking revelation. Miguel and Manuel's internal organs had carelessly been discarded without ever undergoing proper testing. Apparently, the organs had been left sitting on a shelf for days, decomposing to the point of being useless. To make matters worse, the coroner's office reportedly lacked the necessary tools to perform a full toxicology analysis in the first place, meaning any potential clues hidden within their remains were lost forever. As news of this mysterious case spread, Gracinda and her husband came forward to report their sighting of the strange lights hovering over the hill on the night of the incident. They weren't the only ones. Other witnesses began calling the police with similar accounts, fueling speculation about an unexplained phenomena connected to the men's deaths. Investigators in Naturo questioned Carlos and Luisa Sales de Valenzos, a couple residing just 200 meters from the location where the bodies were found. However, they claimed they were merely overseeing renovation work on the property for its owner and had no connection to the case. While searching the house, police discovered a surprising collection of religious imagery, including numerous statues and images of saints. When asked about this, Carlos insisted that he had no ties to spiritualism or esoteric practices of any kind. Determined to piece the puzzle together, police returned to Vietnam Hill to map out the scene in greater detail. During their survey, they discovered an unusual stone marker about 30 centimeters tall and carved into the ground. Some speculated it could have served as a meeting point, a marker for a rendezvous. But who was supposed to meet there? And what was the purpose? This mystery only deepened. On August 25th, the chief investigating officer, Jose Betancourt, along with a group of policemen, carefully examined the peculiar lead masks that were found beside Miguel and Manuel's bodies. However, shortly after handling them, Betancourt suffered a sudden allergic reaction, breaking out in red spots across his body. Whether this was a coincidence, an allergic response to something on the mask, or something even more sinister, it remained unclear. With the initial autopsy failing to determine a cause of death, on August 26, 1966, investigators sought a second opinion. They enlisted Alberto Ferra to review the findings and offer his expertise. However, after examining the case, Farah came to the same frustrating conclusion. The cause of death still remained a mystery. With more questions than answers, on August 27th, the case was escalated to the federal police, who launched a multi-state investigation which spanned five states. Even the Army, Navy, and Air Force Secret Service took an interest, particularly in whether Miguel and Manuel's so-called experiment had anything to do with the unexplained explosion on a Tifona beach months earlier. Meanwhile, Chief Betancourt traveled to Campos to dig deeper into Miguel and Manuel's lives, searching for any leads that could explain their fate. The investigation took a dramatic turn when their friend who took them to the bus station, Alicio Gomez, was arrested and transported to Naturo for questioning. If anyone knew what the two men had been involved in, it was him. On August 31st, investigators in Campos searched the home of Evaristo Fidelis, the clandestine radio operator Miguel had contacted before the mysterious explosion at a Tifona beach. While they managed to locate his antenna, the transmitter itself had already been sold, another potential lead slipping through investigators' fingers. Adding to the intrigue, Sanuel de Barra had no officially registered ham operators, yet just 2 days before the explosion, the Navy had intercepted transmission from three unregistered call signs, CKJ-21, CKJ-22, and CKJ-23. Who was behind these rogue signals, and what exactly was being transmitted? Investigators were again left with more questions than answers. On September 1st, Gomez's lawyer files a habeas corpus request for his release, and the police comply and they set him free. Meanwhile, a shakeup in the investigation occurs. Chief Officer Jose Betancourt is promoted to a new position, effectively removing him from the case. His replacement, Jose Silva, is set to take over at a later date. In the interim, officers Idovam Ferreira, who had originally brought Gomez in for questioning, and Helio Brazil, are assigned to continue the investigation. The next day, September 2nd, Gomez provides what appears to be a solid alibi for the afternoon of August 17th. He presents a receipt from a vehicle parts shop in Campos, which is nearly 400 kilometers from the hill where they died, proving he was there at the time. Later that evening, at the estimated time of the men's death, multiple neighbors confirm seeing him in front of his house working on his car. If his alibi holds true, it would eliminate him as a suspect. But it also raised more questions. Gomez claims that contrary to the rumors, Miguel and Manuel were the masterminds behind the Tafona explosion, and that he merely accepted their invitation to witness the event. Initially, he stated that he traveled to Tafona in Miguel's car, but he later changed his account, claiming that Miguel's car was broken and that he used his own vehicle instead. Vladir Cardoza, who worked for Miguel and Manuel, disputes Elcio's version of events. According to Cardoza, it was Elcio who invited the trio, Miguel, Manuel, and Vladir, to witness something supernatural happening at a Tafona beach, though he provided few details beforehand. He recalls that the trip from Campos to Tafona took less than an hour. He recounts that Gomez went to the beach while the three men waited for about 10 minutes. Suddenly, Gomez returned, running, urging them to leave immediately, as a massive purple light descended toward the water. Cardoza remembers a strong smell of sulfur in the air, but denies hearing any explosion. He also reveals that Gomez was a spiritualist who claimed to be channeling spirits and sometimes identified as Dr. Paul or as Dr. Samuel. Gomez reportedly had significant influence over Miguel and Manuel, who often sought his spiritual guidance. Miguel for his asthma, and Manuel for his chronic stomach issues. Vladir notes that Dr. Samuel always offered sound advice. The four friends, Miguel, Manuel, Vladir, and Gomez, frequently gathered at the shop for lengthy spiritual sessions. Miguel and Gomez were the most enthusiastic, while Manuel remained skeptical until shortly before August 17th, when he reportedly said, quote, "I am going to watch a definitive experiment, and after that, I will be able to tell you if I believe or not," end quote. Police investigations revealed that Miguel and Manuel conducted similar experiments in several other cities. The military questioned whether these experiments posed a threat to national security. Manuel's wife, Nelly, confirmed his participation in the Tafona experiment and disclosed that the lead masks were crafted by Miguel and Manuel the day before their trip to Naturo, using a lead pipe as raw material. Police later found cut pieces of lead at Miguel's house that matched the masks. Manuel had told Nelly that the masks were needed for, quote, "work." Additional masks were later discovered at the shop. A handwritten note with instructions was identified as Miguel's handwriting, but the terminology such as ingest capsules was deemed unusual for his everyday vocabulary, suggesting it may have been dictated by someone who sounded more like a medical professional. The Army's Engineering Institute confirmed that the mask contained no radioactive material, a finding requested by the police due to the mysterious nature of the experiments. The suicide pact theory was quickly dismissed due to several inconsistencies: a lack of motive, the missing money, and the presence of the water bottle refund receipt. Why request a receipt if they didn't plan to return? Were they robbed? One theory explored espionage via radio transmission. And given their expertise as electronics technicians, the codes found with them in the hilltop's remote location, it would be an ideal location for such activities. Another theory focused on contraband. A newspaper from August 17th that was found at the scene featured a story about a partially dismantled smuggling ring, with five members identified and two still at large. Another hypothesis suggests that Miguel and Manuel fell victim to a trap, that they had traveled all the way to Naturo to visit a spiritualist center, where someone learned that they carried a large sum of money, may have orchestrated their robbery and murder by sending them on a fake mission to Vietnam Hill. Lastly, the possibility of a scientific experiment gone wrong still remains under consideration. The police calculated the time it would take to travel from the bus station to Flowskop by bus, car, and on foot. Comparing these estimates to the actual time Miguel and Manuel allegedly took, in every scenario, there is an unexplained time gap, leading some investigators to believe they made an unaccounted stop at an unknown location to meet someone. One investigator noted a well-known spiritual center was located along the route and speculated that they may have visited it to receive final instructions for their experiment. During the investigation, it was discovered that one of the coded notes found with the men was not related to their experiment, but instead contained electronic codes used to identify vowels in analog TV sets. According to Gomez, he had asked Miguel and Manuel to bring these valves and provided them with the corresponding codes. They're identifiers for electronic valves. Both families denied that the handkerchief found at the scene belonged to either Miguel or Manuel. Additionally, the police were unable to identify anyone, whether family or acquaintance, with the initials AMS. There is also a contradiction regarding the wristwatch that was found with the bodies. Miguel's family insisted that his watch remained at their home in Campos, but the police claimed to have found the watch inside of Miguel's clothing. Witnesses at the bar where they purchased mineral water recalled that Miguel frequently was checking his watch and appeared to be in a big hurry. Then, at their shop, police discovered a book titled Vida no Planeta Marte, which translates out to Life on Planet Mars, filled with handwritten notes. In the preface, the author states that the text was dictated to him by a spiritual entity named Romatis, and the book describes Mars as an inhabited planet, detailing various aspects of Martian civilization, including family life, education, culture, religion, entertainment, and technology, industry, transportation, and even government. It includes chapters such as airships, spaceships, and flying saucers, which discusses Martian spacecraft technology and interplanetary voyages. Another chapter, Reincarnation, explains how the spirit of a deceased human from Earth can be reincarnated as a Martian, though native Martians can distinguish between native and foreign spirits. Police also discovered that on August 15th, 2 days before their deaths, Miguel and Manuel had taken the same bus line to Nditoro. However, during one of the stops, Manuel fell ill, forcing them to return to Campos. On August 17th, at the same stop, Manuel again experienced health issues, but this time they managed to reboard the bus and continue on their journey to Nditoro. A toxicology report on the bodies was eventually released, but it was almost certainly falsified. The internal organs had been discarded before any tests could even be conducted, as revealed by that reporter at the time. Idivan Ferreira, the lead investigator, admitted that he was under pressure to solve the case and could not or would not challenge the decisions of the higher administration. 1967, dissatisfied with the police investigation's outcome, the Justice Department ordered the exhumation of Miguel and Manuel's bodies. A new investigation was launched, led by homicide detective Salo Soares de Souza. On August 25th, 1967, the exhumation was carried out by Sebastio Fallas, whose name had been omitted from the previous report. Fallas found that the bodies had been excessively treated with formaldehyde, rendering the proper toxicological analysis impossible. As a result, the cause of death still remained undetermined. In September 1967, the head of security for the state of Rio de Janeiro sought external assistance to solve the case. The U.S. Department of State's Point 4 program, a technical assistant initiative for developing countries that was announced in 1949, was expected to aid in the investigation. In early 1968, as a final attempt to determine the cause of death, bone and tissue samples collected during the exhumation were sent to the Institute of Atomic Energy in São Paulo. However, the analysis revealed that all measured elements were within normal levels and providing no conclusive evidence. In September 1968, R.A. Pereira captured an image of an unidentified flying object flying over Vietnam Hill. The object remained stationary for several minutes before disappearing at an incredible speed. R.A. described the object as emitting an intense silver light, so bright that he had to use a yellow filter on his camera. Numerous other witnesses in Nataro also reported seeing this object. 1969, a woman came forward claiming to know who was responsible for the deaths of Miguel and Manuel. She was taken into police custody, and while they searched for the suspect, the lead turned out to be false, and the investigation went nowhere. In February 1969, Hamilton Dizani, a convicted criminal serving a 50-year sentence for other crimes, confessed to a judge that he knew exactly what happened to Miguel and Manuel. Hamilton claimed that in August 1966, he was invited by three burglars to participate in a job. They met at a spiritual center in Naturo, where Miguel and Manuel were already present. Hamilton drove the group around the city until one of the men instructed him to stop. He waited in the car while the three men left with Miguel and Manuel, and when they returned alone, they told Hamilton that they had forced the victims to ingest poison and had stolen their money. Hamilton was brought to Naturo for questioning, but his story was riddled with contradictions, leading the police to conclude that he was lying. His true motive was to use the trip as an opportunity to escape from police custody. He was sent back to San Paulo and was charged with false testimony. By May 1969, the district attorney assigned to the case was transferred to a new location. His replacement requested the case to be closed despite the ongoing police investigation. In April 1980, Jacques Vallée, a renowned academic who worked with NASA and was a leading expert on UFO phenomena, traveled to Brazil to investigate the case. He climbed Vietnam Hill, spoke with police detectives, and noted that the spot where the bodies were found remained barren, with no grass growing since the incident. Vallée's findings became the prologue for his book, Confrontations, A Scientist's Search for Alien Contact. From there, the lead mask case went cold. Cruz and Vienna were last seen heading to the hills around 3:15 p.m. on August 17, 1966, and 3 days later, they were found dead. End of story? Not even close. Let's talk about the mysterious notes in mass, because this is where things get really weird. The investigators managed to piece together a solid timeline of Cruz and Vienna's movements from the moment they left their hometown. But despite all that, there was still a ton of unanswered questions. And the biggest of them all, the strange notes that were found on the men. It's not clear if the last line is a single sentence or a multiple abbreviated sentences. It could be, wait for the signal from the mask, or wait for the signal, then use mask. The first page of notes was pretty straightforward. Well, as straightforward as a list of serial numbers for electronic parts can be. There were a few Ohm's law equations scribbled underneath. But then, this is where things take a sharp turn into the Twilight Zone territory. The next page, that's where it gets creepy. The notes mention capsules and include a detailed schedule for when they should be taken. And then there's the third page, where things go full-on cryptic. The note says, 4:30 p.m. Be at the specified location. 6:30 p.m. Ingest capsules. After the effect, protect metals. Await signal. Mask. Here's the kicker. The handwriting matches samples from Vienna's home, so it's almost certain that he wrote these notes. But here's where things get even weirder. Both families confirmed that Cruz and Vienna typically didn't use some of the words that were found in these instructions. So that begs the question, were they following someone else's directions? And the masks weren't see-through, so it's not like they were using them to protect their eyes from a bright light or anything like that. So what were the masks used for? Were they some kind of tribal ritual gear? Welding masks? Honestly, your guess is as good as mine. The masks were found on either the ground or the men's faces. Reports vary on that detail, but what we do know is that they were photographed separately at the crime scene. And let me tell you, looking at those photos is like staring into the void of unsolved mysteries. So where does that leave us? Well, the capsules mentioned in the notes were never found. If Cruz and Vienna did ingest something, possibly poisonous, we'll never know what it was or why they took it. And thanks to the coroner's backlog, toxicology tests were never done. And as for the masks, they remain one of the biggest enigmas of this case. Were they part of some spiritual ritual, a misguided attempt at protection? The lead mask case is one of those mysteries that keeps you up at night wondering what really happened. And honestly, I don't think that we'll ever know for sure. But one thing is certain, this story is equal parts fascinating, bizarre, and downright chilling. Let's dive into some of the prevailing theories presented in this case. It's clear that Miguel and Manuel were deeply involved in spiritualism and its practices. It's also believed that they were participating in some kind of unusual experiment in Naturo, having received instructions from a third party and preparing themselves in advance. If they truly bought into the fantastic stories from the book by Romatis, it's possible that in their minds, they were genuinely going to communicate with or even meet beings from another planet. In the end, this was their naivety that got them into trouble. Miguel and Manuel fully expected to return to Campos after the experiment, but something clearly went wrong. As for their return trip, if they planned to use the same bus company, the departure times for Naturo to Campos were 6 p.m., 10 p.m., and 12 a.m. We know that the 6 p.m. bus was out of the question because they were supposed to be at the hilltop by 6:30 p.m. The next available time slot was 10 p.m., which would have required them to stay in Naturo for several hours after the appointment at Vietnam Hill. To me, this suggests they were counting on someone in the city to support them, at the very least to provide a place to stay for a few hours. It should be noted that they didn't bring any luggage, so they clearly didn't plan on staying overnight and returning the next day. And of course, every detective story has its shady character. And in this case, that role falls to Alcio, their spiritualist friend. I have no doubts that he knew exactly what was going on. He may not have been directly involved with their deaths, but I believe it was his influence that led Miguel and Manuel to experiment on the hill. I don't think that Elcio expected them to die, but once it happened, he chose to keep a low profile and withhold information from the police. One of the biggest missteps in this tragedy was the failure to conduct a proper toxicological analysis. Without it, the cause of death remains a mystery. The entire investigation suffered as a result. Was it a poison? How long did it take to act? Was it a fatal combination of medications? An overdose? For a long time, people believed that a toxicology analysis had been done and came up empty, which only fueled speculation that whatever killed them was not of this world. Then there's the UFO angle. Some people point to their sighting as evidence of something otherworldly. When we piece together all the details, one aspect of the death scene really stands out as unsettling. The bodies were discovered lying on their backs, carefully positioned on a layer of leaves that appeared to have been deliberately gathered and arranged. It's plausible that Miguel and Manuel laid down on their own, following the instructions they'd been given, swallowing the capsules and securing the masks over their faces. But what strikes me as odd is the apparent lack of struggle. If this was a case of poisoning, wouldn't there have been some kind of distress? Wouldn't they have convulsed, perhaps gasped for air, or clawed at their throats as the toxins took effect? And how is it possible that both men died at the exact same moment, leaving neither a chance to help the other or even cry out? If this was part of a grand, calculated scheme to rob them, stage their deaths as some kind of failed paranormal experiment, it raises even more questions. Wouldn't the perpetrators have worried that through toxicological analysis would reveal traces of poison? How could they have been so confident that no such tests would be conducted? It's hard to imagine that they could have predicted the investigation would be botched to the point where the organs were discarded before any analysis could be done. The whole scenario feels like a tangled web of contradictions, too deliberate to be random, yet too flawed to be the work of masterminds. There's a gaping hole in the logic here, and something that doesn't quite fit. And it leaves me wondering what really happened on those final moments at Vietnam Hill. The truth is, we still don't know what happened to Cruz in Vienna. Some people think they were trying to contact extraterrestrials or otherworldly beings. Others think that they were experimenting with some kind of homemade technology. Maybe they were trying to see into another dimension. Were they victims of foul play? Did they accidentally poison themselves? Or did they stumble onto something far bigger and far stranger than anyone could have imagined? Almost 60 years later, their deaths remain one of Brazil's most enduring mysteries. The lead mask case is still unsolved. It's the kind of story that keeps amateur sleuths and conspiracy theorists up at night, scratching their heads and wondering what really happened on Vietnam Hill. Mysteries like the lead mask case remind us of just how strange and unexplainable our world can be. No matter how many theories we explore, some questions may never have answers. But that won't stop us from searching. If you have your own strange encounter, whether it's a cryptid sighting, a brush with the paranormal, or something even weirder, I want to hear about it. Send me an email at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. Whether you want to share your story or you're interested in being a guest on the show, I'd love to connect. You can also keep up with Dark Florida on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast and on YouTube at youtube.com/darkflorida411. And if you want to support the show, check out buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. Thanks for listening. And as always, stay curious and stay strange.